excuse me. Okay, we left off, we had finished discussing the morality or Shila component of the path, which in terms of practical ways of going through the Eightfold Path means the next thing we will discuss is mental cultivation or meditation. And the three components that go there are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So right effort, there's two descriptions of right effort, but the simplest one is not too much and not too little. So it's again finding that magical middle path. And this is especially talked about in terms of how to meditate, how much effort to put into staying with your reference point versus how much kind of leeway you give yourself. And the guideline is not too tight, not too loose. That if you try very, very hard to meditate right, correctly, you usually miss the mark. But on the other hand, if you are very lackadaisical and don't care at all, and just let your mind wander freely without any discipline at all, you also miss the mark. typically, if people are too tight with their meditation technique, people get very frustrated. People develop headaches or tics or, you know, all sorts of mental, physical problems. So right effort in terms of not too tight, not too loose, is very important, and it's also said to be something you really have to find yourself, that no teacher, no matter how good, can give you the magic formula. They can suggest you might be being a little too easy on yourself, or they can suggest you might be trying too hard, depending on how you talk with your meditation instructor, what you report. But in the long run, you know, that the precise right effort has to be something that each person discovers. And I also would say it changes sometimes, you know, changes throughout the course of one's meditation experience. One of the big teaching stories on this point of view of right effort is a story that's often told about the Buddha, who had a student who had been a musician, a lute player, I believe, and he could never get it right. I mean, he never could understand what the Buddha said when the Buddha said, follow your breath, but don't be too tight, don't be too loose. He just couldn't get it. And finally, the Buddha said to him, you used to be a musician, right? And he said, yes, I was a musician. And the Buddha said, so when you played your musical instrument, if you tuned the strings too tightly, what happened? Well, the pitch was off or the strings broke. If you tuned your instrument too loose, what happened? Well, you couldn't even play it because the strings were too loose. And the Buddha says it's exactly the same thing. You have to tune your instrument, your mind, body, just right. And just as a musician knows when they've got their instrument tuned right, correctly, I should say, so a meditator knows when we have right effort. Though, you know, again, it's one of those things you don't get once for all. There's another description of right effort, which is a little more technical. It's continuing good activities that one has started, starting good activities that you haven't yet begun, refraining from negative activities you've started working on, and not taking up any new bad habits. So, right, it's about the same thing. If you are doing things that aren't so wise or healthy, cut it down. Don't start any new ones. In other words, don't start smoking in middle age, I guess. And whatever you're doing, continue it and try to do some more. So, right effort. And then right mindfulness and what's usually translated as right concentration are the other two components of the meditation path. Right mindfulness, the mindfulness is a word that's very popular and very familiar these days. And I define mindfulness myself as knowing what you're doing when you're doing it. So I'm breathing and walking and eating and sitting down. And not with a heavy emphasis on the I, but more like the walking. You could even drop the pronoun walking, breathing in, breathing out, sitting down. So the this is a text, comes from a text, or there's a major text that has been rediscovered in the 19th century and is very, very widely used today, which I'm sure you study here a lot, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, which I'm sure you're all somewhat familiar with. So that sutta goes through the four foundations of mindfulness and how to practice with each one of them. The first foundation of mindfulness being mindfulness of body, which begins with the instructions. If you are breathing a long breath, know you are breathing a long breath. If you are breathing a short breath, know you are breathing a short breath. And there are 8 or 9 exercises in mindfulness of body. The mindfulness of body exercises end with visualizing your body as a corpse going through its various stages of decay. I don't know how often people get to that one, but that's actually an important part of mindfulness practice. And it's very important to recognize the inevitability of death and to really talk to that. It's very, very, very important. In Tibetan Buddhism, one of the first important meditations is precious human body, free and well-favored, difficult to obtain, easy to lose. So you start with appreciation of having a body. And then the second thing that you contemplate very deeply is death is real and comes without warning. This body will be a corpse. In the meantime, I should do something useful. So to begin with appreciation of the body and end with clear mindfulness of the inevitability of death. In the Tibetan tradition, they're said to be what will get your butt in gear. So that's a colloquial way of phrasing it. That if you really get these 2 points, you cannot help but try to do something with the life we have. Framing it between appreciating having a human birth and the inevitability, and in a sense, the finality of death. In between, in the four foundations of mindfulness, we find meditations that people often find they have a lot of resistance to doing them, but there are contemplations on how the body is made up of all sorts of things that if we just take them by themselves, we're not so attracted to. Mucus, saliva, excrement, bile, etc., etc. That's part of the reality of the body, too, that while it's important to have a human body, the wrong kind of attachment to that human body leads us down the wrong path. There are contemplations about knowing what you're doing, when you're doing it, sitting, walking, standing, lying down. It's a very pithy list, excreting. That can be your subject of meditation when that's what you're doing. So mindfulness of body, and then mindfulness of feelings is the second foundation of mindfulness. Feelings in Buddhism, there's really only primarily 3 feelings: attraction, aversion, and couldn't care. It's not about refined emotions. It's just about wanting something, being very attracted to something, which leads to greed and grasping. Aversion, really not liking it, which leads to aggression and hatred. And couldn't care less, which means I don't think it affects me, but it easily slips into ignorance. So what I find instructive about the instructions on the foundations of mindfulness of feelings is that the text simply says, know what your state of mind is. It doesn't say fix it. It says know what your state of mind is. And, you know, that's so important in a sort of basic meditation instruction that it is very important to acknowledge what I've been thinking or feeling. It is utterly unimportant to make a judgment about it. In fact, it's counterproductive. We're never encouraged to say that was a bad thought, I should never think that way, I have to stop myself from thinking that way or whatever. It's know what your state of mind is. Know what your feeling is. Then the third foundation is mindfulness of mind, which has more to do with knowing whether one is distracted or, you know, I haven't been able to stay with my object of meditation for 10 minutes. Just knowing. I've been daydreaming. I've been lost in thought. I'm paying close attention. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of phenomena. Mindfulness of dharmas is the technical term, but mindfulness of dharmas here means mindfulness of phenomena. Mindfulness of the environment, mindfulness of whatever is going on. In the most older versions of it, you actually go through all of the basic teachings of Buddhism when cultivating mindfulness of phenomena. But many people interpret it as, you know, cultivating awareness of the environment. So that's the sort of short version. And something that I have notes in my computer for a whole weekend of teachings, and I'm sure many of you have been through extended teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness. And then right concentration. The word concentration is very difficult to translate. Because many people hear the word in English and they think it means being focused on one single thing to the exclusion of everything else. Whereas what it really seems to mean is not being distracted. Being aware of the entire field of what is going on without particularly glomming into one thing. And that's something that's kind of hard to discern from the text. They're written and, you know, they're not utterly clear on this point. But going into altered states of consciousness, while done in Buddhism, has never been considered to be that helpful in the long run. This is, if we go back to the life story of the Buddha, again, this is where we can see a lot of where these, the life story of the Buddha was written after the teachings were written down, so his life story sort of points out the teachings. But after he renounced his home, he had two teachers, and he progressed very quickly to what they had to offer, and they said, why don't you become co-teacher with me, lead the community with me, and in both cases, he refused because the meditations he had done with them had taken him to a very refined state of consciousness that was very pleasurable. But he still said, no, this is not it. This is a mind-created and therefore impermanent state of mind. It does not bring true, lasting peace. It does not bring real cessation. It brings a kind of false cessation of I'm temporarily able to withdraw from sensory phenomena, but as soon as I come out of this state, they'll all be there again. Which is, you know, what a lot of people experience with certain kinds of meditation. They're pleasant while they last, but then when they're over, nothing has changed. So there are, in the early Buddhist texts, there are eight stages of concentration or samadhi. And really only the first four are important to go through. Because the last four seem to be these almost out-of-the-body states of mind that are possible but are not that highly, not conducive to liberation. And it's always said in the books when you're talking about enlightenment, that enlightenment is attained from either the fourth level of concentration or from an ordinary state of mind, not from one of these trances, not from an out-of-the-body kind of thing. So I will read, because I've taken this out of the technical descriptions, and I think it's very helpful, I will read to you the first four levels of absorption or samadhi, or what I think is, really, I think I would translate it as non-distraction. It's not a literal translation, but that's what it feels like. Because distraction is the big problem with meditation. And distraction means, what does distraction mean when we're meditating? It means that we have something to do, which is, in the long run, to dwell in the natural state of mind, or the all-encompassing ordinary state of mind, in what some texts call natural nirvana. And what we do instead is glom onto something catches our attention. Usually it's a thought catches our attention, and we're off to the races with that thought. That's a distraction. It absorbs us in a very limited, specific thing and distracts us from the natural state of mind, or from mind without clouds and confusion. We get distracted because we follow some sense perception or some thought. And you know how it is. When you're sitting and meditating, things can be going quite well. And then all of a sudden you're thinking about the shopping list. Or you're thinking about, what am I going to say in this program I have to teach tomorrow? Should I do this first or should I do this first? That's a distraction. And samadhi or meditation is not being distracted by any of that stuff, but just really, really, could we use a cliche, being here now? So I think the first four levels of concentration give us a very good description of how we actually progress from being quite beginning to more and more ability to stay undistracted. Yes.
Is this what we call the jhanas?
Yes. Oh. Yes, they are called the jhanas. The first jhana, this is the full description. Detached from sensual objects and unwholesome things. So, you know, we're not grabbing after sensual objects. We're not thinking about things we shouldn't be thinking about. Enter a state characterized by applied thought, sustained thought, rapture, and happiness. So there's still thinking going on. Probably the thinking of, what is my object of meditation? Have I lost my object of meditation? And, you know, the rapture and happiness. When we get used to meditation and we're in a long meditation retreat, we usually become quite happy. It feels good. It usually doesn't feel good for the first hour or the first day, but we get into a long meditation retreat and it feels happy, it feels good. Second jnana, applied and sustained thought subside. So there's less need to hold on to a specific reference point. Less need to be always following the breath, or we get lost in thought. So the point of having the reference point is that it keeps us from getting distracted. But that's only a stage along the way. That's not what we're really aiming for. So applied and sustained thought subside. Rapture and happiness remain. Still like it. It still feels good. And single-pointed concentration enters. Now, single-pointed concentration, I think that's the word that's very misleading. That it doesn't mean focusing on, you know, this purple shirt right in front of me and forgetting everything else. it means taking in the whole room without being specifically attracted to any one point in the room. You see the difference? The single point is the whole field of awareness, not one little molecule. Okay. And so we still have rapture and happiness. That feels good. Single pointed concentration feels even better than applied and sustained thought. The third jnana, rapture subsides, leaving happiness and single pointedness. So this sort of too excited, I like this feeling goes, and just very even happiness and single pointedness remain. This is probably like in a week-long retreat, by the third day we'd probably be feeling this way. And then the fourth jnana, even happiness departs and is replaced by equanimity. Equanimity. So it's an even less, it's a state of mind. Equanimity is less subject to fluctuation than happiness. Because if you have happiness, it can also give way to unhappiness. But equanimity can take in anything without preference. Take in the good and the bad without being made upset by the bad things and ecstatic by the good things. You can take it all in without a lot of preferences and favoritism. Considered to be very, very important in meditation. And then I'll just give you the names in the last four jnanas, if you want it, for your information, of what I have no idea what these mean, because I've never tried to do them myself, but this is what the texts say. The fifth jnana is one becomes aware of or dwells in infinite space. In the sixth is infinite consciousness. In the seventh, nothingness. And in the eighth, neither perception nor non-perception. And someday I'll investigate those a little more, but in 40 years I still haven't, so I don't know that it's a high-ranking project. The higher jnanas are not pursued by Tibetans, and that's one of the reasons why I haven't really ever done anything with what that might be. But the first four, I think, are a very good description of what happens when we do a calm abiding or a shamatha meditation into beginning of vipassana. I think it's a very good description of, you know, that you still use thought in the beginning. There's a lot still going on in the beginning, but you detach from sensual objects and from craving. The thoughts might come up that you're detached from, and that gradually refines your mind. So that's a brief look at the meditation component of the path. Any comments before we move on?
Is this referring only to the happy that you're feeling during the meditation, or is it also the kind of the calm happy that you're
hearing? I think it's both. I mean, the formal meditation, Trungpa Rinpoche used to say the reason we sit down is to get up, which means that if there's no carry through from your formal practice into daily life, you're missing the point. So I personally think it's much easier to see that meditation is working in how we are in our lives than it is on the cushion. You can tell I'm not as reactive as I used to be. I'm nicer to the checkout people. And you can see that, and other people can also see. As you were telling me at lunch, your co-workers are saying, gee, you don't seem to get as upset anymore. So I really do very strongly Well, and I've heard other teachers say this too, that if you meditate and your fuse gets shorter and you get mad more, it's not working. You're doing something wrong. You need to take a look. You need to take stock and find out, you know, what's going on here, because that's not the point.
You found that, I've noticed that the way meditation feels is like you just have a cyclical, or the periods where I feel calm, I don't have all the scattered thoughts, or it's easier to focus, good, bad, isn't that? But then have you found that there are times where, like I find that I all of a sudden my mind is telling me stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to try to focus and bring it back to a focus that there's something. Mm-hmm. And I guess the way I translate it is that there's something going on that my mind is trying to make me pay attention to, and I'm trying not to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that is really what's happening, but.
Well, I'll answer it in two ways. I think that you know, there just are ups and downs. And some days one is restless for no particular reason. And also I've heard teachers say, you know, when that happens, it might be more productive to go take a walk than to sit there fighting with yourself. And that's so many people, especially, I mean, Westerners who can be so puritanical about things, really, you know, oh, I should be harder on myself. But it is sad, and I've, you know, really discovered that to be true, that when the mind is too active, well, first of all, when you first start to meditate, your mind is very active, and people come to the teacher and say, I thought this was supposed to calm me down, I'm thinking more than ever, to which you say, No, you're not thinking more than ever, you're just noticing how much you thought you think. But then, you know, that chills out. And I've heard people say that when you actually are somewhat experienced and your mind is so agitated, your technique is too tight, you're trying too hard. And many people do just the opposite, they think they should try to clamp down more and more. But, you know, people say things like, you know, dim the lights, make your room colder.
It's more like lately I found that it isn't the way it was when I started meditating, that catches you more, you're taking 82 million things you can try not to. But
right.
It's more like dreaming, only I'm not asleep. Like suddenly
That could be drifting. That could be just drifting. Be careful about that. It's very hard after a while to discuss being spacious and spacing out. Very, very subtle. And a lot of people think that they're being very spacious and accommodating of everything when they've actually gotten, there's no discipline at all.
Isn't there something to be said for knowing your surroundings, even though you're meditating, you're still aware of where you are and what's around you?
That's what I would say. I've never been taught to try to dull my sensory stimuli. Or to dull my senses, rather. Pay less attention to sensory stimuli, but not dull your senses or close your senses down. My teacher always says, you're not a corpse. Of course you're going to have sensory sensations. But just watch them. Don't get caught by them. Don't get distracted. Don't glom onto this most interesting new stray sensory perception and go with it. But it's, you know, the way she says it is it's very humorous and very refreshing. Of course, you're not a corpse. Of course you're going to have sensory stimuli. Don't worry about it. Just don't get distracted. Don't buy into it. That takes a certain amount of discipline. No. So that's why, you know, when we catch ourselves lost in thought, we immediately stop it. Lost is the operative word. anything else? So that brings us to wisdom, or prajna, right view, and right intention. What? P-R-A-J-N-A. Pana, P-A-N-N-A, if you're using Pali instead of Sanskrit. So we come to wisdom, or which consists of right view and right intention, which in a certain sense, you know, the path is so cyclical. I think the reason, especially for people like us who are not going to be just born Buddhists in an Asian Buddhist country doing lay Buddhist practice all our lives, there has to be some glimmer of right view to get on the path at all. You know, that we have some sense, hey, this sounds true, and therefore if we go somewhere. And usually for us, we learn to meditate first, and we don't appreciate the importance of merit and ethics until quite a bit later in our journey. I see some nods. How I was attracted to meditation, ethics, I heard about that my whole life. So we have some glimmer that this sounds true, this sounds good, and then we know that we don't know how to meditate because we don't learn that in our culture, so we go learn to meditate, and then finally we take on ethics. So maybe we do it a little bit backwards, but it gets us where we are. So right view, in the long run, right view or view is very, very important in Buddhism because it's always said you could have perfect ethics, you could even have perfect samadhi, but if you never come around to the view, it isn't truly liberating. It isn't going to really calm you down and give some peace. So it's right view is really, really important. But on the other hand, you could intellectually have the right view. You could get an A on the test and not have much idea. I'm sure many of my students at the university gave the right answers on the test, and did it make any difference in their lives? I doubt it, because they hadn't internalized. They had learned the words, but they hadn't internalized the meaning of the words. There's a very, very important distinction in Buddhism between words and meaning. Words are easy to get. It's important to have the words down correctly, so that you know whether you're turning right or turning left. It's important to have the words down correctly. But you always have to plumb the meaning. And unless you've really gone for the meaning of the words, you still are far from liberation. You're still far from happiness and peace. So right view is usually said to consist of really understanding the Four Noble Truths. And, you know, it doesn't matter what other variations on view we get, whether it's in Mahamudra or Dzogchen or Zen or anything else. It comes down to understanding the Four Noble Truths. And then right intention, which is fundamentally the intention not to cause trouble, not to be a nuisance. The intention to however things may turn out, but the intention is to be helpful, to be kind, to not cause trouble, to not be a nuisance. Which I've not quite seen it done in the text, but I think you could put here, you could easily put here the four immeasurables. Kindness or friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, which is another set of those basic categories. I've also got a whole weekend program on the four immeasurables here on my computer. Really important stuff. And I think that if you understand the Four Noble Truths, which includes understanding interdependence and emptiness. And you understand the four foundations of mindfulness, and you understand the four immeasurables. That's the package. You've got it. Now you can get anything in Mahayana or Buddhism out of that. So we've now gone through, still on page one, we're just about to turn to page two. We wouldn't have to discuss the other three noble truths if we fully got this. There would be no need to even discuss suffering because it wouldn't be an issue for us. There wouldn't be a need to discuss clinging because it wouldn't be an issue for us. And there wouldn't be a need to discuss cessation because we would already have experienced this. So, should we go on? I realized, I just saw this moment. The last retreat I did with my teacher, she was teaching kind of in this manner, and then she'd get to the next point and she'd say, well, if you must. If you must go on and do more, if you can't. So, those were very eager yeses, let's go on. So this might be the point to do it. Let's go through our eight magic words. What are our eight words? Who can do all eight? Who can do the first one?
Understand suffering.
Understand suffering. Abandon cause, abandon clinging. Missing. Experience cessation. Experience sensation or unbinding. I'm glad you remembered that word. And then practice the Eightfold Path. What?
Repeat
those again?
Yes. Understand suffering. Abandon the cause.
Abandon the cause. We've got to know what the cause is. Abandon clinging. Abandon grasping.
Experience.
Cessation. Practice. This is the Eightfold Path. So, as we just said, if we had fully assimilated the truth of the path, we wouldn't need to go into a discussion of suffering or grasping and craving or cessation, because we would already have assimilated, grasped, understood that material. But since we didn't, we'll go there. And it's just very interesting. I think I'm going to ask for your recommendation. I made this decision on the spur of the moment while I was sitting up. This is the first time I've taught this program, going through the Eightfold Path in such detail before getting to the first three truths. What do you think? Is it a good tactic? You've heard me do it. You've done both. You've heard me do it both ways.
No, I like going through the Eightfold Path first to make more sense.
Okay. Because our minds are precious, that's what we hear first.
Well, I'm putting into the sequence. Uh-huh. Okay, we can understand this, so that you have all this understanding, and then you get to the action, and it's way down the list.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate the putting.
I'll keep that in mind. I don't have any more. I'm sure someday somebody's going to ask me to teach this program again. So I'll keep that in mind.
Well, one thought I have is that we just went through the how.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we're up to the why. And yeah, you could do it in either order, but one of the things is like I see it screw up all the time on the house. And I'll say, yeah, I know that's true, that's true. All these right things should be all the right way of this. And then like, well, I screw up all the time. And part of the why it has to do with to him understanding myself. What this time in the mind. What function is.
So I think the first three truths are a very tight unit logically. Starting with the statement of fact, there is suffering. The first truth is often mistranslated as all life is suffering. That is not a correct understanding of the first truth, and that's a very important point. It is not saying all life is suffering. It is saying there is suffering. There's a huge difference between the two. If it were the fact that all life is suffering, then we might as well push the button right now, because it would contradict the third truth. So that's really, really important, and I cannot tell you how often it's misunderstood that Buddhism says all of life is suffering. What I would say, if you want to put in all in front of it, all conventional thinking ends up in suffering. All conventionality or all conventional ways of living wind up producing suffering. And by conventional ways of living and thinking, I of course mean self-cherishing. Grasping ways of thinking or being, they definitely lead to suffering. But it is not the case that all life is suffering. Otherwise, the third noble truth wouldn't be true, and there'd be no point in doing anything, and, it would be hopeless. So it starts, the system, it starts with the fact there is suffering. That next says, well, why? The two-year-old's favorite question, why? Because if we know the why of something, then we have a chance not to do that. If we know that standing water breeds mosquitoes, we know cover up the standing water. If you don't want mosquitoes, cover up the standing water. You know, the logic of Buddhism is that simple and straightforward. So the why in the sutra is answered mainly with grasping or desire. As I said this morning, and this is important, later on, as I read the Pali Suttas and study early Buddhism and the life of the Buddha, I think that as the Buddha taught more and more, he wanted to ask another why question, and that is why are people so filled with grasping and desire? Why, if grasping is the cause of suffering, why is there so much grasping? And that led him to the word ignorance. That led him to the word ignorance. And behind ignorance, you can't go. There is no answer to why are we so ignorant, except that we don't wise up or we don't practice the Eightfold Path. But beyond that, there is no why to why is there ignorance. So, it's very interesting. One of the main slogans for Buddhism and one of the main slogans for Christianity are the same. You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. The truth that needs to be known seems to be somewhat different. So we know now, we've got the fact, the why, and then now that we know the why, the good news that the fact of suffering can cease. So it's just very, it's just very tight and very, very tight logic. This is the case. This is why it's the case. If we don't do the why, the case changes. if we give up the why, no, if grasping is the cause of suffering, and if we give up grasping, suffering ceases. So there's like a triad relationship between the first three truths, that we have the cause, if we insist on indulging the cause, our suffering will increase. If we give up the cause, our freedom and our peace increases. It's just that simple. If we insist on indulging in the cause, well, of course, I often say that it's like getting stuck in the snow in the winter. At a certain point, you have to stop spinning your tires because you're only going to dig yourself in deeper. You have to take a different solution. Get somebody to pull you out or something. If you don't continue to indulge the cause of suffering, suffering ceases. So people have often talked about the relationship between the four truths in terms of a relationship between the first and the second truths, and then the third and the fourth truths, as first truth is an effect, second truth is a cause. The effect is suffering. We always say cause and effect, but really the way karma works, and you were through this program last spring, the teachings of the 12 Nidanas really talk about the effect. What we are experiencing at present is an effect. It had a cause. The effect of suffering is the effect of the cause, which is grasping, clinging, thirst, however we contemplate it. That works pretty well for the first and the second truth, but when people say the third truth is an effect and the fourth truth is a cause, I always throw down some red flags, because that's really